Once, the great hope to restore the Habsburg dynasty to Spain, to realize a restoration of the legacy of Charles V, the greatest of the Habsburgs. Charles the Thick, Holy Roman Emperor, would instead serve as the Austrian counterpart to his unfortunate cousin and namesake, Carlos II, the Bewitched, whom Charles had meant to succeed in Spain. For Charles was the last of the mainline Habsburgs, and left the Austrian possessions, the remnant Habsburg monarchy, on the brink of collapse. Charles VI's reign represented trauma. Trauma for the loss of the Spanish inheritance, and trauma at the impending extinction of the dynasty. An exemplary builder, a superlative exponent, if not the superlative exponent, of the Spanish style of court, a terrible strategist, and an incompetent military leader, Charles was the worst of the Habsburg emperors, a fact only obfuscated by his cultural achievements and by the remarkable, if not miraculous, deliverance of the dynasty by his daughter and successor, Mary Theresa. As the second son of Emperor Leopold I of Austria, he was never expected to inherit the throne, not at least until it was very obvious that his brother was infertile as a result of him contracting syphilis. Instead, when the War of Spanish Succession broke out in 1700, following the death of Carlos II, Charles was allotted as the Habsburg male line successor, and eventually would go off to attempt to claim his Spanish inheritance. In appearance, Charles united the features of both his parents. One eyewitness who saw him at dinner in 1703, as he was leaving to take up the throne in Spain, described him of middle stature, of slight frame and thin legs, has large, brown, beady eyes and eyebrows of the same colour, a long and nearly straight nose, and somewhat flabby cheeks, and a hanging underlip, of course the typical Habsburg feature. The expression of his features rather stern and melancholy, and he seems of an impatient temper. Whenever he seized anything, or cut up his meat, or pushed away his plate, he always did so with an appearance of a certain and awkward abruptness, which could not escape notice. Charles had travelled more widely than any of his predecessors since Charles V. He visited England on his way to Spain, was received by Queen Anne, and made much of by the ladies of the court, whom the Queen had specially selected for their charms, in a desire to impress her visitor. After dinner, he played cards with the Queen and was escorted to his chamber by the bevy of English beauties, after bidding the Queen good night and receiving a present of jewels to the value of £50,000, that especially in the context that he was going off to fight a war, really on the part of the English. However, he found the English too boisterous and avoided an invitation to return. He arrived at Barcelona after a long sea voyage in August of 1705 and spent the next 6 years in a rather desultory campaigning for his new kingdom. The summons to return in 1711, albeit as the new emperor, following the unexpected death of his brother Joseph, was unwelcome to Karl, or Charles. He had been away from Vienna for almost 8 years, and had met his love, his Spanish mistress, the Duchess Pignatelli, then aged 18, shortly after he arrived in Spain. And when his wife arrived in Barcelona in 1708, his wife, of course, being Elizabeth Christine of Brunswick-Wolfenbüttel, he married the Duchess to his imperial chamberlain, Count Altheim. Altheim was his master of horse, at her apartments close to Charles. He and the new Countess Altheim met every day at the same hour. She accompanied him to Vienna, while his wife, Elizabeth, remained as ostensibly Queen of the Spanish in Barcelona. When considering this Spanish adventure, what was the intended course of Charles's relevance to the Habsburg dynasty? It was not only a failure, but the entire strategy was an extension of British foreign policy rather than Austrian foreign policy. As I mentioned in the previous episode in the series dealing with Joseph I. Joseph I had grand imperial ambitions for his particular branch of the Habsburg dynasty, the Austrian Empire, the inheritance of his father Leopold, and he believed that the future of his dynasty remained in Italy. And by 1709, on the back of a series of military triumphs, per his great generalissimo, Eugene of Savoy, Joseph had achieved his dream and had made himself the master of Italy, and indeed he had basically subjugated the papacy along with all of the other lesser princes. The only prince in Italy who could hold a candle to him was of course the Duke of Savoy, who would later be created King of Sicily and ultimately King of Sardinia. This meant that Spain was a peripheral consideration for him. Joseph was content to steal the Spanish possessions in Italy and, of course, in the Netherlands, rather than he was content to place his brother on the throne of Spain. Indeed, it was British maritime power and the intervention of the Portuguese, more than any Austrian direct intervention, which helped Charles claim his throne. That and the fact that Spain at the time was a collection of kingdoms, not a single kingdom, the two most prominent crown assemblies being that of Castile and being that of Aragon. So when Charles VI, the later Charles VI, arrived in Spain, it was in Catalonia, and Barcelona was the centre of his power. This is important to consider in terms of the lasting legacy of Charles's Spanish expedition, because it never seemed as if he had any realistic chance of claiming the Spanish inheritance. Indeed, only 2 years after landing in Spain, his forces were decisively defeated at the Battle of Almansa, after which it was clear that Philip V would consolidate the entire Spanish inheritance within Spain itself. So what was the ultimate outcome of his legacy in the grand geopolitical picture, geostrategic picture of Europe at that time? Well, it was the extension of British interests. Portugal had started the war on the side of the French and flipped to side with the British by 1704. When Karl arrived in Barcelona, it was off the back of the British military victory in Gibraltar. Gibraltar, of course, being a mainstay of the British Empire and now even the overseas territories of the United Kingdom for the last 320 years. In addition, Britain would seize Mallorca. If anything, one can look at the Spanish adventure and see that Britain was laying the foundations for its maritime empire in the Mediterranean, usurping that position from the French and the Spanish, and this would only be confirmed in successive conflicts. So Charles VI was an instrument of the British, and once in 1709, 1710, 1711, as the British were opting towards a peace settlement, when it seemed very obvious that Joseph had no successor and that Charles would ultimately inherit the thrones of potentially both Spain and Austria, the British dropped him dramatically in 1711, and 2 years at the Peace of Utrecht made peace with the French, ultimately compelling the Austrians to sue for their own peace treaty at the Peace of Rastatt. All this is to say that the Spanish experience, not to mention his Spanish mistress, had led an indelible effect on Charles's own conception of himself and that of his potential empire. He had wanted Spain to be the cornerstone of his empire. He had wanted to restore Habsburg glory as a second Charles V, and he had been denied so. He had been at the whims of the British and ultimately betrayed by Joseph, who was more concerned in aggrandizing the possessions of Austria. And so he returned unhappily to Austria in 1711. But that is not to say that the beginning years of his reign were evidence of the future decline of his possessions in the last decade of his reign, where it became most evident. Rather, thanks in part to his generalissimo Eugene of Savoy, who would remain in command of military affairs of the empire until 1720, this period was a period of consolidation for the Austrian possessions, albeit Spain and Spain's overseas empire would be lost forever. In this I mean, in the successive conflicts, the War of the Quadruple Alliance, not only did Austria prevent an attempt by Philip V to reclaim his Spanish his Italian possessions, once part of the Spanish inheritance in Sardinia, Sicily, and Naples, at the behest of his new wife, Elizabeth of Parma, Elizabeth Farnese. But indeed, he was able to compel, with British support, the transfer of the Savoyard Kingdom of Sicily for that of Sardinia, a much poorer possession. And indeed, Sicily and Naples together could restore the Habsburgs to supreme power in Italy, albeit briefly. This success in Italy was mirrored with the Balkan campaigns of Eugene of Savoy. Of course, from 1683, in the Great Turkish Wars, the Austrians, alongside their Holy League allies, most prominently Poland, had advanced into Hungary and pushed the Ottomans back in the greatest series of successive territorial defeats for the Ottomans for 200 years. However, this is not to say that the Austrian conquest was stopped there. Rather, in 1718, the Austrians seized Belgrade. They had therefore established a principal base of operations to conduct further potential conquest into the Balkans, and had established themselves in Oltenia, which was then part of Wallachia, what is now southwestern Romania. Indeed, with the fortress of Belgrade under Austrian control, it is likely that we could have potentially seen a Danubian Empire, decades, or rather centuries, before the Austrians would annex Bosnia-Herzegovina and declare war on Serbia in 1914, which is very important to consider the possibilities afforded by Eugene's conquests. But Charles had nothing to do, ultimately, with the exploits of Eugene. Indeed, the military successes of the Austrian Empire can accurately be said to be contained to this period in history. It is something which is seldom replicated, furthermore, with a brief moment of military glory in the Fifth Coalition War against Napoleon. So when Eugene of Savoy undergoes his general decline, his mental decline, and his slipping away from the forefront of Austrian politics from the 1720s onwards, it marks a serious decline in the fortunes of the Austrian Empire, which is not helped by the fact that Charles VI had essentially abandoned much of the reforming impulse of his brother Joseph. Joseph had begun the attempt, which would later be fulfilled and ultimately balked by his successor and namesake, Joseph II, that being to reform the institutions of the Erblander, the core possessions of Austria, Bohemia, etc., into a cohesive political and tax-raising unit that could levy troops in the constant wars against France. Because, of course, as Joseph I eagerly prosecuted the war against France, Charles VI did not lack this intense antipathy towards France as a military power and all aspects of French culture, and the attempt of France, and especially Louis XIV's court, to eclipse that of the Austrian imperial court in Vienna. So this is the context in which we see a gradual and comparative decline of the Austrian possessions, because Charles VI did little to innovate in the forms of the administration, and he essentially abandoned the army after Eugene of Savoy's own retreat from the forefront of politics. So despite these consolidated gains that we see in the first decade of his reign, despite the loss of his own personal ambition to be King of Spain, we see a number of military disasters following soon after, most notably in the War of Polish Succession. On the one hand, Austria was able to get its preferred candidate, the Elector of Saxony, on the throne of Poland, but Poland was becoming a dead weight in European politics by the 1730s, a fact that would be exposed later by the partitions of Poland. So gaining Poland as an ally had ultimately very little relevance, and instead Poland would later gravitate towards being a Russian vassal and not an Austrian vassal. Instead, the most notable effect of this conflict, the Polish War of Succession, was not the fact that the Austrians were quote-unquote victorious in gaining their own candidate on the throne of Poland, but rather the fact that the son of Philip V and Elizabeth Farnese, who had attempted to restore the possessions of Spain in Italy and had failed doing so, it was through her son that her ambitions were realised. Because in 1734, from his base in Parma, the would-be Charles III of Spain marched into southern Italy and almost bloodlessly was able to restore those territories as a single kingdom under his own direction, taking those lands and adding them to the Bourbon Pacte de Famille, now augmented with France and also Spain. This, to my mind, was one of the greatest humiliations for the Habsburgs in history. For Joseph I, this had been the cornerstone of his policy, first of all establishing Austrian hegemony in Milan in the north, cajoling the papacy to abandon its alliance with France, a would-be second league of cognac, and then extending Habsburg rule into the south, into Sicily, into Naples, but more so, the conquest of these regions, ensuring that they did not fall into the hands of a weaker power comparatively, would mean that, despite the fact that the British were establishing a major maritime presence in the west, in Minorca and Gibraltar, Austria now had a counterweight with which to challenge the ostensible ally, Britain's growing influence, maritime influence in this region. Instead, all of that had been lost, and the dreams of a Habsburg Italy or the restoration of some sort of imperial legacy pertaining to Italy and Rome itself died as a result of this brilliant campaign from the would-be Charles III of Spain. But if that was not enough, in concert with the Russians, Charles joined, who was Empress Anna of Russia. She wanted to gain territories in the Black Sea, and Charles VI wanted to continue the conquests that had been laid down by Eugene of Savoy. Not only did Russia fail in its ambitions, but ultimately Austria was pushed back, thrown out of Belgrade and thrown out of Wallachia, settling the border along the military border of Hungary, which would remain stable for several hundred years, barring, of course, the odd war and the odd skirmish, which shouldn't be overlooked. So not only had the dream of Italy subsided, after which Austria would be localized to northern Italy, but the dream of a Balkan empire, of a Danubian empire, had been stymied. These military defeats and the lack of reform meant that the Austrian army had been fundamentally neglected and experienced this role of defeat. This is despite the fact that Eugene of Savoy didn't actually die until 1736, but it is very clear that his star at the time was fading, and that can account for the fact that Charles VI lacked a suitable successor to Eugene, and that his military success was contingent upon the great generalissimo. In that way, not only do we see the loss of Spain, but we see the retraction of the great gains made by Joseph and Eugene, and the prospect that the Habsburg Empire was teetering at a moment when the succession, the fact that he had no male heir, and he was organizing the pragmatic sanction, the dynastic consolidation of his domains into something that could be inheritable for his daughter, was all happening at a time where the Habsburgs were deemed incredibly weak, unable to support themselves militarily, and indeed were dependent on allies who would ultimately not prove reliable, such as Britain, as Britain had demonstrated in the War of Spanish Succession, where they were content to use Charles VI's candidature as King of Spain in order to extend their own empire into the Mediterranean. But this should not be obfuscated for the fact that Charles VI's legacy, again obfuscating the fact that the Austrians endured many of these defeats, happens amidst a great cultural flourishing, one of the greatest cultural flourishings of the Habsburg dynasties in Austria, which shouldn't be overlooked. This, what I'm reading now, is a segment from The Habsburgs Embodying Empire by Andrew Wheatcroft, A Cultural History, which I also use to elucidate the cultural policies of Leopold I. In most accounts of Charles VI, it is suggested that he imposed a rigid Spanish etiquette, as if he had never lost his longing for his lost kingdom. But the Spanish tradition was already well established in Vienna, and he did little by way of innovation. Nor was it so much a Spanish style as a Habsburg style, a conscious rejection of the dominant French model. The most obvious difference was the remarkable piety of the Austrian court. The Duc de Richelieu, more used to the relaxed standards of the French court, wrote to the Cardinal Polignac after a particularly trying Lent in 1726, "I have led a pious life here during Lent, which has not left me free for a quarter of an hour, and I avow that if I had known the life that an ambassador leads here, nothing in the world would have determined me to accept this embassy. Only a Capuchin with the most robust health could endure this life during Lent. In order to give your eminence some idea, I have spent altogether between Palm Sunday and Easter Wednesday 100 hours at the church with the emperor. In the streets outside, there were crowds of people beating themselves with whips, while on their chests they carried notices listing their sins. Others dragged heavy chains through the streets and penance, or carried massive crosses on their backs. Most, if not all, were masked. A great many Viennese joined in the processions and the public penances, although some observers noted that the release from the normal social restraints on public display of emotion, the masks and concealment, allowed a good deal of profane lovemaking. These fervent displays of public sorrow echoed Holy Week, as celebrated in Spain, which can still be seen to this day, rather than anything native to the city. For the court, as for the citizens, the Lenten season culminated on Maundy Thursday, when the emperor received 12 ancient paupers at the Hofburg, and formally washed their feet in imitation of Christ, and on Good Friday the court went to each of the city churches in turn to pray at the sepulchres. Easter came as a blessed relief. In the interior of the Hofburg, the most strictly measured Grandezza reigned paramount. It was a strange medley of Olympian revelry, of Spanish monastic severity, and the rigorous discipline of a barracks. The court costume was Spanish, the predominant hue being black, the imperial livery according to the armorial colours, a double-headed eagle, always black on a golden-yellow background. The head coachman alone always wore the yellow velvet pelisse, with a yellow velvet cap with a white plume on it. All the court carriages were black. The emperor only drove in his red body coach. The emperor and all his courtiers wore the Spanish dress and short Spanish cloaks, all black, with point lace. On gala days, his majesty wore a gold brocade or scarlet and gold embroidered dress. The only article of dress borrowed from France was the powdered flowing wig, which Leopold I already wore his time. However, the life of the courtier was not all grandeur and genuflection. Charles's passion for hunting and for the simpler country life caused him to escape from the constraints of the court as often as possible, if only for a few hours of the day. The Hofburg itself, apart from the new wing constructed by Leopold, had few attractions. A visitor in 1704 described it. Within the apartments of the emperor, the walls thick and ponderous like a city wall, the staircases dark without any ornament, the rooms low and narrow, the flooring of common deal, meaner than which could not be found in the house of the humblest citizen. All is as plain as if it were built for a poor friar's. On a small spot called the Paradise Garden, fenced in within the walls under the windows of the apartments of the Empress, some flowers and shrubs drag on a stunted existence. He, as well as the courtiers, were bound and restrained by the rules of behaviour, but in the country palaces, the Favorita, the Laxenburg, the Emperor and the courtiers dressed more informally, in the German style, and in general there was greater liberty. The prohibition of French influences was absolute. In the French dress, especially the white stockings, the Habsburgs always wore red and red shoes. Even during the time of Charles VI, no one dared to show himself at the Hofburg. The emperor, as often as he saw anyone attired in that way, would at once cry out, "Here is one of those confounded Frenchmen." The antagonism to the French lessened under Mary Theresa, with her French-speaking husband, Francis Stephen of Lorraine, when the old regulations for the Spanish styles were progressively relaxed, until they were abolished under Joseph II. Prussia, at least for Mary Theresa, had replaced France as the enemy. Charles VI's new empire was outwardly more successful and prosperous than any of its predecessors, if it were judged by its lavish building programme alone. His ambitions paralleled those of Louis XIV and Louis XV. He intended to build the temple of the dynasty in the most holy of Habsburg shrines, the abbeys surrounding the burial place of St. Leopold of Klosterneuburg on the hills just outside the city, overlooking the Danube. It was to be the equivalent of the Escorial outside Madrid, which had been lost forever to the Bourbons. The knowledge that his ancestors were now buried in an alien soil horrified him, and this may have encouraged his daughter in her later campaign to recover the bones of her more distant ancestors in Switzerland and to rebury them in securely Habsburg and Catholic soil, these of course being the Habsburg ancestors in Switzerland, and emphasizing this idea that Charles's reign was compounded by the trauma of the loss of Spain. The motive behind the creation of such a shrine, as has been suggested by Frederick here, talking of the great Baroque monasteries, he wrote, "The Baroque revival of monasteries is remarkable as an attempt at restoring the union between the empire and the kingdom of God. The Baroque houses of Austria aspire to this self-same harmony. Church, cloister, imperial salon, library, art collections, cabinets of natural objects formed an indivisible whole. The great staircases found in these houses are often of an unfurled escutcheon, proclaiming this last Western communion between the separated spheres. At Gottweig, for example, the emperor enthroned in the heavens as a sun god, of course an imitation of Louis XIV, is surrounded by allegorical figures of the arts and the sciences. These are both monasteries and imperial palaces. The cloister is a mansion. The different spheres, imperial and sacred, religious and political, scientific and artistic, intersect. Melk, the monastery complex, merges into its cliffs, Gottweig into its mountain, dazzling monasteries built onto the rock of the victorious empire, the empire conceived as an imperial church, hearkening back to the Ghibelline legacy, the idea that the Habsburgs are the imperial dynasty, they are the successors to the Hohenstaufens directly through the course and the legitimacy afforded to that of Rudolf, the idea of the imperial and the sacred, of the divine mission of the House of Habsburg. And indeed, if one looks at the Imitation of Escorial, it is obvious that not only was Charles VI looking to Charles V as his immediate inspiration, but also to Philip II. The plans for the Kloster Neuburg were designed by one Daniel Graham, the architect of the Imperial Library, in the form of a modified grid, like the Escorial, but with 12 great towers. 6 were capped by huge stone crowns, each one different and representing one of the Habsburg lands. One tower above the staircase, well, had the double eagle of the empire at its pinnacle, and the 3 towers of the chapel were marked by the double cross of Lorraine. Inside, in the fresco for the imperial salon, Grand promised to display the glory and majesty of the House of Austria, the House of Habsburg, stemming from the Babenbergs, heightened by the Habsburgs, and prolonged in the Lotharingians, of course, the House of Lorraine, which would succeed the Habsburgs with Marie Theresa and Joseph II. Charles's apotheosis in the Imperial Library is even more grand and marks the curious conjuncture between the Habsburg sense of the written word as power and the temple of dynastic identity. This building mania rested on an uncertain foundation, however. By the late 1730s, the dynasty certainly seemed likely to come to an end. Charles had no son, and unless his wife, Elizabeth, achieved a biblical miracle on par with that of the mother of John the Baptist, he would have no male heir. Unless, that is, she died and he married a younger woman, that was not to be. Failing a male heir, the Habsburg family, which had held the imperial throne continuously since Frederick XIII in the 15th century, would be excluded from the imperial title. In 1713, Charles VI had set aside the promise he had made 10 years before and created a new family statute that made his own rather than his brother's line the heirs to the Habsburg lands. Moreover, he established a strict principle of primogeniture, something that the Habsburgs had toyed with since the 16th century, but had always found inconsistent with the traditions of the family and uncertain in its effects. And by that I mean the Habsburgs were always conceived of as an extended family, and there were many subsets of the Habsburg dynasty ready in the male line to replace various failing aspects, such as Matthias with Ferdinand III, and indeed the fact that the house itself had split into a Spanish branch and to an Austrian branch, the idea being that there should always be male Habsburgs to supplement all of these potentially failing lines, whether in the smaller localities such as further Austria and the Tyrol caught Austria itself and Bohemia, and that, of course, Spain. This policy, of course, had failed dramatically, with the failure of the Austrians in the War of the Spanish Succession, and it is perhaps in response again to that trauma that Charles is seeking to consolidate his own succession primogeniture within the domains that have been left to him. In 1713, Charles had no children, so that the declaration was represented as a future rather than a present intention. It was placed into public law as the Pragmatic Sanction, and ratified by his estates and the governments of Europe. And of course, this varied. The estates in Hungary, say for example, would take 10 years to ratify this agreement. Indeed, this is an awkward situation, because Leopold and Joseph had attempted so hard to establish a hereditary system of succession in Hungary, and all of a sudden, with the prospect of female succession, all of these plans seem set to unravel. The Pragmatic Sanction is an imperfect solution to this, imperfect in the sense that it would not prevent war, and of course the fact that the relationship between the Habsburgs and Hungary would be fraught until the end of its existence, that of the demise of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Charles's first child was a son, Leopold John, born amid much rejoicing in April 1716, but he died on the 4th of November of the same year. Some said that his second name was unlucky for the Habsburgs. In the following year, his second child, born 13 months after the first, was a daughter, Mary Theresa, who immediately became his heir under the terms of the Pragmatic Sanction. Another daughter, Maria Anna, appeared in equally short order in 1718. The final child of the imperial couple was Maria Amalia, born in 1724, though she died in 1730, and there were no more young Habsburgs to fill the imperial nursery. Not only that, the extended line of the Habsburgs, considering the fact that Leopold I, the Holy Roman Emperor, was in a sense a miracle, and the fact that all of his extended family had died, Joseph was a miracle in the fact that he prevented the early destitution demise of the male line House of Habsburg, but in turn his infertility and Charles VI's inability to produce a healthy male heir who would survive to adulthood, of course, all compounds to make the succession crisis particularly acute. Increasingly, during the 1720s, it was the common assumption that his heir would be Mary Theresa, and the direct line of male succession could be traced back to the 11th century, with the original Counts of Habsburg, would be ended. In one sense, this posed less of a problem in Habsburg's lands than a country like France, where a female could not rule. There was no such problem in the Habsburg lands, and the women of the house traditionally fulfilled political roles. Charles's own sister, Mary Elizabeth, governed the Spanish, or now Austrian, Netherlands on her brother's behalf from 1725 to 1741, and was followed by his younger daughter. Mary Theresa could technically rule Hungary and Bohemia as their queen, and the Austrian lands as their archduchess, but she could not be elected to the seat of Charlemagne, where the old Carolingian and Salian rules, commonly known as the Lex Salica, prohibited the election of anyone save a man. However, the Habsburgs, for good reason, remained fixated upon an empty title whose powers were increasingly theoretical, although the imperial legal and financial structures continued to exist and to function. Habsburg primacy and prestige was built around their imperial status. This they had buttressed and supported consistently since Charles V in publications, public inscriptions, coinage and medals and works of art. Two connected themes ran through all these activities. The first was the antiquity of the Habsburg line, their natural sanctity and their imperial descent. The second was that these characteristics and qualities made them the natural and appropriate occupants of the imperial throne, the first family of Europe. The image of Charles V's twin columns plus ultra, like Frederick's AEIOU device, remained a popular motif in the House of Habsburg. The architect, Johann Fischer von Erlach, placed two vast columns modelled on Trajan's columns in Rome, but showing scenes from the life of St. Carlo Borromeo outside the Karlskirche, dedicated in 1713. This was Charles VI's thanks offering for the end of the plague in the city. Fischer von Erlach had also worked as an assistant to the architect Bornacini on the plague column erected by Leopold, a monument even more replete with complex dynastic symbolism. His first design for the Schönbrunn, which would later be built under Mary Theresa, had sported two towering pillars as a grand entrance. the imitation of the plus ultra design of Charles V. But as any child knows, knock away one of the columns supporting a house and it will collapse. One of the pillars of the House of Habsburgs was the imperial title, and it was questioned whether it could survive without it. So, on the one hand, the pragmatic sanction was the core to retaining the Austrian possessions, yet not sufficient to ensure that a woman would ever inherit Charles as Holy Roman Emperor. There were only two ways that the situation could be resolved to ensure that his successors would retain the imperial throne. One is that of the election of Francis Joseph to be, or rather simply just Francis, to be elected as Holy Roman Emperor alongside Mary Theresa. Another possibility was that the Empress Elizabeth would die, that Charles would be able to remarry, and that that son would then be elected King of the Romans and assume the Holy Roman Imperial dignity. So in this sense, Charles cannot be faulted for the fact that the imperial title, at least for a brief spell, as it did occur historically, would be lost to the House of Habsburg. But that is not to say that he can be absolved from the many diplomatic blunders and a lack of reforming impulse within Charles, and that to hold the empire together, as it was then constituted during his reign, with a strong army to present to the world a fait accompli of his daughter's succession to prevent the demise of the Habsburg lands themselves. Even though the imperial title could be temporarily lost, it was at least within his power to hold the Austrian Empire together, the Austrian Empire that was already fraying and decaying within his own lifetime, as I stated, with the loss of southern Italy and the severe and humiliating setbacks in the Balkans, as per the decline and the general fading of influence of Eugene of Savoy, as Charles himself was responsible for the diplomatic and military conduct of the empire. On the one hand, the pragmatic sanction was an internal settlement to ensure that primogeniture could be established throughout the remaining domains of the Habsburg Empire, and indeed this was also an attempt to challenge the electoral traditions of monarchy in Bohemia and in Hungary. But alas, he could not challenge the electoral conditions within the empire of the German nation itself, thus allowing his daughter to become the next empress, or emperor, if one is to be specific. What do I mean by the diplomatic failings, the pragmatic sanction, which is the corollary to the internal pragmatic sanction? That the European monarchs had to accept the integrity of the lands of the House of Habsburg and its aftermath. Already, this condition had been upset by the fact that Charles III, later Charles III of Spain, Charles of Parma, had so dramatically and humiliatingly dispossessed the Habsburgs of Naples and Sicily. But perhaps of equal significance in terms of the loss of Naples and Sicily and the implications of the Habsburg Empire in the Mediterranean, after which there would very much be an empire on the Adriatic as opposed to being able to exert power on the Mediterranean, is the fate of the Ostend Company. The Ostend Company, to my mind, is representative again of this trauma, the trauma of losing Spain, the trauma of the loss of the great Spanish possessions in South America, in Mexico, in the Philippines, etc. Even though the Spanish Empire was in decline vis-a-vis the growing power of the Dutch, the French, and the British in the New World and in India, the focus after the fall of Eugene of Savoy in the 1720s for Charles VI was in establishing a particular Austrian legacy for colonialism and outward expansion. If this had been allowed to continue to fruition, this colonizing impulse, it is possible that Austria, from its base in the Austrian Netherlands, Belgium, which could project power out to the North Sea and counteract the English, the French, and the Dutch, could have established themselves as a major colonial power to rival any of these nations. Instead, this was not to be, and this was not to be as a result of the cowardice, and indeed, a consistent theme with Charles VI is that he was essentially a dupe to the British. He had been a dupe to the British in his Spanish campaign. He had been dramatically dropped by the British in 1711, when it was obvious that the British were simply fighting for a collective inheritance of Spain and the Austrian possessions under one monarch, which they had ostensibly attempted to frustrate with France. They had already gained their strategic objectives in Gibraltar and in the Western Mediterranean, so it was convenient now to drop Charles. Now that Charles was attempting to establish a new trading competitor to Britain, this had to be very quickly quashed, and this, of course, is the Ostend Company operating out of Antwerp. What is more remarkable is the fact that within a very short amount of time, from 1719 onwards, around the same time that Austria is victorious in the War of the Quadruple Alliance and seizing Belgrade, the Ostend Company focuses principally on the tea trade with China. In this sense, the Ostend Company was innovating in terms of the potential expansion of overseas trade, while also establishing a significant presence in India. This at a time, crucially, where it was not evident that Britain would become the dominant power in India. That wasn't obvious until the Battle of Plassey, some 40 years after 1719. So the Ostend Company was perhaps the greatest innovation of Charles VI, and of course the greatest betrayal. For despite the fact that very quickly on, the investments provided by the monarchy into the company were quickly producing a 15% dividend. By 1726, it was producing a 33% dividend. By 1727, responding to the British and the fact that the succession was now in jeopardy, the fact that it was very unlikely that Elizabeth was going to produce a son, the emperor, as per the pragmatic sanction, instead gravitated towards the British as being able to hold up the remaining possessions of his empire. What I find most remarkable about this is the fact that even if one looks at the successes of Marlborough alongside Eugene of Savoy in the War of Spanish Succession, Britain did not have a major army to be able to stand up with the French in a prolonged conflict. So it was not obvious that Britain should be the main principal military partner, especially when Britain was Austria's main naval rival, maritime rival, which is evidenced with the Ostend Company's foreclosure. In 1726, the emperor begins to suspend the operations of the Ostend Company, and in 1731, he abolishes it entirely. And this, of course, is a condition for the alliance. This essentially meant that Charles was prepared to economically and militarily inhibit Austria in order to gain unreliable allies. And this in part explains why Mary Theresa would move away from Britain and that she would affect the diplomatic revolution of the 1750s, ultimately believing that Britain was unreliable, as it had been during the War of Austrian Succession, something that Charles VI should have been acutely aware of. Of course, the other effects of the pragmatic sanction is the fact that Leopold I had already set the precedent in 1703 when creating his own device for the succession that his own daughters and their progeny should be disinherited to prevent an incredibly complicated system of claims and inheritances. But the fact is that Charles VI, very controversially, also dispossessed the daughters of his elder brother Joseph, who arguably had a much better claim on the throne than Mary Theresa had. This is significant because they had married into the houses of Wettin in Saxony and the houses of Wittelsbach in Bavaria. Therefore, both Saxony and Bavaria had a very strong claim on the imperial title. Indeed, it is with Bavaria, with French support, that the imperial title would briefly be wrested from the Austrians to be afforded by the Wittelsbach, even if it only lasts for 5 years. So this is a significant implication of the pragmatic sanction. And again, even though there is outward recognition of it, all this does is allow these powers to buy their time, to consolidate their armies, to build up their potential alliances for a war. This is what Bavaria does already before the death of Charles VI in 1740 by concluding a secret alliance with France in 1738. So Charles VI was content to accept tacit support of this sanction while the nations of Europe were building up their arms to oppose it with these very justified claims, albeit Saxony by primogeniture perhaps had the best claim. There is something to my mind that Charles VI cannot be blamed for, which is the Prussian situation. The Prussian situation, which is the most memorable in terms of the most devastating defeat suffered by Austria in the War of Austrian Succession that followed his death, where Austria lost Silesia, part of the Crown of Bohemia and one of the richest possessions of the Austrian patrimony. This is because Frederick Wilhelm I, King of Prussia, had been a stalwart ally. Yes, he had a very powerful army, which Frederick II the Great was able to utilize against the Austrians. But Frederick II didn't inherit until 1740, the same year that Mary Theresa would replace her father. So it was not obvious that the Prussians would dramatically reverse their alliances, that Frederick II would not only betray Austria, but that Frederick II would be so dramatic and bold in utilizing an incredibly weak claim to wrestle Silesia, which was really nothing more than a military fait accompli and nothing else, that was simply ratified later by the powers of Europe and confirmed in the Seven Years' War from 1756 to 1763. So that, to my mind, cannot be blamed on Charles VI, given the fact that Frederick I and Frederick Wilhelm I had been major allies of Austria. But that is not to say that this accounts for the fact that Charles relied on prestige. He relied on court culture, affectation, prestige, ultimately transitory and ephemeral prestige, to hold together an empire which should have presented the world a indomitable military strength as that of the first power of Europe in contest with France. It should be attempting to dispossess France of her claims of being la première nation d'Europe, the first nation of Europe. Instead, Austria relied on a series of faint promises which would ultimately amount as broken promises. They would amount to nothing. In 1740, Charles was still in vigorous good health and secretly hoping that he might remarry. Mary Theresa had married Francis Joseph, in November of 1736, and by the summer of 1740, the emperor had three granddaughters but no grandson. And indeed, if he had a grandson, it is possible that Mary Theresa could have skipped the succession, giving it to her son, thereby allowing him to claim the imperial title. Then in June, his eldest granddaughter died, but in the following month, he learned that his prolific daughter was pregnant again, perhaps with the future archduke. In early October, he set out from La Favorita to go on a hunting trip as usual, hoping for a good bag of duck. The weather was atrocious, with a series of cold, grey days of constant snow or sleet, but nothing would keep him from his favourite pastime. He had arrived at his hunting lodge, suffering from mild stomach pains, and thought nothing of them. After several days of extreme cold, the pains worsened, but he continued. On the evening of the 10th of October, his cook had prepared a stew of mushrooms, which the emperor, always hungry after a day in the field, ate voraciously. He was violently sick in the night, and his companions hurried him back to Vienna, with Charles vomiting and fainting along the way. Once in bed and under the care of his doctor, he seemed much better, but on the following day he had a relapse, and plainly whatever it was that ailed him seemed likely to prove fatal. His family gathered at his bedside, but he gave instructions that Mary Theresa was not to see him in his haggard state, lest it bring on a miscarriage. Over the space of a week, he settled his affairs, gave his ministers their instructions, received the consolation of the faith, and prepared to die well, like all true Habsburgs. At 2 a.m, his bed surrounded by tapers due to an archduke, king, and emperor, and holding a crucifix, he died, the last of the male line Habsburgs. To compensate for his dynastic failure, the failure of the ancient Habsburg male line and that of that succession, he relied on exalting the prestige of the House of Habsburg. But how can one delineate a new and uncertain direction for the new dynasty of Habsburg-Lorraine on nothing more than myths and legends? It is remarkable that Mary Theresa preserved a Habsburg patrimony at all when Charles VI had failed to preserve that territory during his own reign. It was beyond his grasp to consider that one negotiates from a position of strength, that to make peace one must be prepared for war. Rather than presenting his daughter's succession as a fait accompli to the world, her right defended by an indomitable military, the sovereigns of Europe circled the Habsburg lands like vultures around a carcass. In 1711, the dream of Charles was of a restoration of the empire of his namesake Charles V, plus ultra, Austria est imperiale orbi universo, the device of Frederick III. The reality, the nightmare of Charles's reign, was the loss of Spain, the loss of a colonial enterprise before it could even begin, the loss of vast territories in southern Italy and the Balkans, and now, with his death in 1740, the loss of the imperial title and the possibility of losing the remnants of Bohemia and Hungary, the Austrian core, which had once belonged to the Babenbergers, would pass now from the Habsburgs to the House of Lorraine. Charles VI was indisputably the worst of the Habsburg Holy Roman Emperors as it pertains to the realm of geopolitics, as he was technically the last.